This is Mishmash, a weekly conversation where we try to unjumble an important and sometimes under the radar statewide story that affects you. I'm Shayna Roth.
And I'm Zach Gorchow.
Three mass shooting incidents last weekend in Detroit, Lathrop Village, and Rochester Hills raised new questions about what can be done to reduce gun violence.
Yes, the shooting of 9 people at a splash pad in Rochester Hills with a 4-year-old and an 8-year-old among the injured especially restarted the conversation, considering that a man with no known motive opened fire on families just trying to seek some relief from a hot day. It's also the 3rd active shooter tragedy in Michigan in the last 3 years, coming on the heels of shootings at Oxford High School and Michigan State University.
Now, unlike after those shootings, however, this time there was no immediate mobilization for new gun legislation, at least not yet. The MSU shooting prompted a quick wave of bills from the legislature that Governor Whitmer signed. Things like enhanced background checks, new registration requirements, new criminal liability provisions for gun owners whose firearms are used by someone else in a crime, and a new judicial mechanism for seizing firearms from people seem to be a danger to themselves or others.
There are some bills sitting out there on firearms and school safety, but at this stage, it's not yet clear whether new laws might have prevented the Rochester Hills splash pad shooting. There's been talk of banning bump stocks, which make long guns fire automatically, or letting local governments regulate firearms. Right now, only the state can do that. But neither of those would seem to have made a difference here. The Extreme Risk Protection Order law that took effect in February could have helped. But at this point, it appears no one raised concerns with law enforcement about the shooter, so no attempt was made to have his guns taken.
Zach, you spoke to Jordan Hermony, a reporter for Bridge, Michigan, and also a former Gong War reporter, on the initial reaction from state officials, and here's what she said.
We had a law on the books, and laws are only as good as when they're used. From what I'm hearing from lawmakers who are pretty involved, the first response I got was, well, we need to see and have things bear out, have police's investigation bear out. We still, as of this point, don't really have a motive as to why this individual decided to come to a community he seemingly had no relation to and open fire. We had a procedure in place to potentially off-ramp this individual before something bad happened, and it wasn't used. How do you make people utilize a law? And is it fair to say that if you knew, you should be criminalized or penalized as well? Because then you get into the persnickety of, well, to what degree did you know? There's just so many tendrils that thought would have that it almost seems virtually impossible to try and legislate off of this tragedy, knowing that we kind of had everything in place potentially to cut it off before it happened.
Now, this presents a more complicated situation for the Democratic majority in the legislature. After the MSU shooting, there were several pent-up pieces of legislation they could quickly agree on. Now, the low-hanging fruit is gone, and there's not the same quick consensus. Zach, do you think there's any chance there might be some rapid movement before the legislature adjourns in, a week?
That seems highly unlikely, Shayna. They have their hands full with so many other things, including the budget. And I think some folks are going to take some time on this one.
We're going to take a short break, but stick around because when we come back, Zach is talking with Bridge, Michigan reporter Jordan Hermony on this topic and much more.
Welcome back to Mishmash. I'm Zach Gorchow. Our guest this week is Jordan Hermony, Capitol reporter for Bridge, Michigan. Jordan is also the Capitol Press Corps resident expert on Russia, a great hockey fan, even though she unfortunately likes the Pittsburgh Penguins, and best of all, a former Gongwarian whom we were lucky to have on our staff. Jordan, welcome to Mishmash.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So Jordan, you quickly reported and wrote a story after the Rochester Hills shooting about why none of the new gun laws that took effect in Michigan in February stopped this shooter. Can you tell us what you found?
Yeah. So just for people who might be unfamiliar, back in February, Michigan put into law a host of new gun regulations, one of which provided people the ability to file what's colloquially known as a red flag order. Basically, if you believe a loved one And there's, it's very specific who can file these orders, but effectively, if you believe somebody is close to you who they are at risk of hurting either themselves or others, and you believe that they need to have their firearms taken away from them, that'll usually last for about a period of a year if a judge grants it. But like I said, you have to make the case. It's a court document, goes in front of a judge. So with the splash pad shooting in Rochester Hills, it was found that no risk protection order was used at all, pulled some of the ones from Macomb County, which we know the shooter was from. There was nothing there. And it turns out that while his family seemed to be somewhat aware of extenuating mental health concerns, nobody sought to apply one of these orders. I don't really want to speculate on why that is. But yeah, so that wasn't used. And then Saturday's shooting did unfortunately occur.
And Jordan, it really seems like a very different response in the legislature now than after the Michigan State University shooting over a year ago. This time, there's been no quick rush to get new bills introduced or any signs of like, hey, we're going to take action right away. What do you make of that?
So I think the important caveat here is that we had a law on the books, and laws are only as good as when they're used. Effectively here, from what I'm hearing from lawmakers who are pretty involved or had been involved with crafting this red flag policy, the first response I got was, well, we need to see and have things bear out, have police's investigation bear out. We still, as of this point, don't really have a motive as to why this individual decided to come to a community he seemingly had no relation to and open fire at a splash pad, injuring, you know, families and children. So they're waiting for that. But then also, I think the difficult thing here is we had a procedure in place to potentially off-ramp this individual before something bad happened, and it wasn't used. And I don't necessarily know, and from my talks with lawmakers, it sounds like they might be on the same page, you know, how do you make people utilize a law? And is it fair to say that if you knew, you should be criminalized or penalized as well? Because then you get into the persnickety of, well, to what degree did you know? Did you make a change? Like, there's just so many tendrils that thought would have that it almost seems virtually impossible to try and legislate off of this tragedy, knowing that we kind of had everything in place potentially to cut it off before it happened.
So is there a next frontier or a likely next frontier for Democrats who control the legislature on gun legislation, regardless of this most recent incident? And of course, there were two other significant mass shootings in the Metro Detroit area over the weekend as well. What would be on the short list for possible next bills to come up if the legislature were to return to firearms regulation?
So from what I have heard, there were a host, even before this shooting in Rochester, there were a couple different gun laws and reforms that Democrats were eyeing. I know one of them was Kelly Breen, a House Democrat from Novi. She's been leading the charge on a lot of this legislation. She's shown interest in trying to crack down on ghost guns, which are guns without a serial number. Those make it incredibly hard for police to trace, which is actually how police were able to find the Rochester shooter, is because he ended up leaving a gun at the scene that was traced back to a home that he was found to reside in. So cracking down on ghost guns, I've not heard much yet, but there's also potentially the appetite for at the Supreme Court recently. They bumped down the federal Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court. They bumped down a ban on bump stocks, which enables guns to fire faster. That was implemented not long after a huge mass shooting in, I believe it was Vegas.
That's right.
That was implemented after a huge mass shooting in Vegas, wherein a gunman was able to get off just a crazy amount of rounds, injuring and killing just dozens of people. So whether there's appetite there to ban bump stocks at the state level, that remains to be seen. And then I know that I've heard from lawmakers as well about the possibility of revisiting red flag again, but not necessarily from, and these conversations came prior to the Rochester shooting. I will put that caveat on, but it sounds like there might just be a bit of paperwork slog where it takes time to really get these going and trying to cut down on the red tape behind the scenes so that, for instance, if police, and in my reporting, I've actually found that 75% of all of the red flag orders that have been granted so far in the state, 75% of them have been initiated by law enforcement instead of families or mental health professionals. So law enforcement are the predominant agencies using these. And it sounds like the ability for them to be able to execute them and not have as much red tape in the background might also be something that there could be appetite for later this year.
So let's turn to the topic that's dominating the Capitol right now. Governor Whitmer and traditional K-12 public schools seem really deeply at odds about what to do on the K-12 budget. And we're only, by the time this broadcasts, 9 days away from the end of the school fiscal year. Are you surprised resolving this question about state payments toward retired public school employee healthcare is the one major holdup in the budget?
Am I surprised that this is the sticking point? I guess if you had told me this a year ago, that it was retirement pay would be the big thing that we're all talking about in the final minutes of the budget, I think I would minorly be surprised. But when you take a step back and realize what the governor is attempting to do, it seems like we're trying to look at using this retirement money to try and accelerate her goal of free preschool for all of Michigan's eligible four-year-olds, which, you know, in talking with especially Darren Camilleri, he's a Democrat in the Senate who is responsible for crafting the Senate school aid budget. Outright, he told me that he does not think we're at the point to be able to pay for free preschool for all. He doesn't think that that's a realistic goal at this moment in time. And it seems like the governor's side of things is adamant that this does become something that we can accomplish and can accomplish quickly. Now, whether that's because Governor Whitmer would like this policy goal that she announced, you know, over a year ago, be able to put a stamp on it, be able to put a bow on it, that's where I'm at, where her thought process is that this looks great for the Whitmer administration. This looks great for Michigan to be able to say that we have free preschool for all. But, you know, if it's coming on the back of the teachers who end up having to educate these individuals as they move through the school system, obviously that's going to ruffle a lot of feathers.
So is there any hope of the legislature getting anything done besides the budget before the summer break?
You know, that's a question I ask myself almost every day when we walk into the legislature. It's never a dull moment, that's for sure. The big thing is that we need to keep in mind is that the House is still a highly contentious place in the Michigan legislature. You know, whatever Democrats need to get done, unless there is complete lockstep unanimity on it. Excuse me. If Democrats need something done, they need all members voting on it. They need every single Democrat present and voting yes. Otherwise, they need Republican votes to pass anything in the House. And obviously, you need to pass both the House and Senate before it goes to the governor. So Democrats in the House are going to need to work hard with Republicans. And it's interesting already, you're seeing flags go up on big things. I know SOAR funding has been a constant conversation, the strategic outreach an attraction reserve. It's a fund to help entice businesses to come site in Michigan, allegedly bringing in jobs with it. You have Democrats in the House who have no interest in voting on that. Dylan Wagella is a Democrat from Garden City, has been a constant thorn in the side of Democrats there. And then you have Republicans too, who, you know, going back to the MIPSers conversation, who are saying, you know, if you want us to help back you on SOAR, we're not going to play ball unless this you know, $600+ thousand retirement fight that's going on, unless that gets resolved. So there's a lot of horse racing that's definitely going on. And if anything of consequence is going to be passed prior to the summer break, all I have to say is that we're probably going to need to expect a lot of long nights coming up.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the only thing I've seen that even I would say is kind of newsy that is nearing the finish line is probably the medically frail prisoner legislation to get, you know, infirm prisoners out of the prisons and off of the healthcare costs of the state so they can be under house arrest. That's nearing the finish line. But we're sort of in the same boat, Jordan, where we just look in and we're like, what even will happen here in the next week? And I think we are looking at some really long nights coming up. Of course, the reason they all want to get out of here is to campaign. And you had an interesting piece in Bridge not too long ago about candidate disqualifications. And those are definitely up in the last 4 years. What do you make of the surge in candidate disqualifications of late?
So it's interesting. We really saw a huge spike in candidate disqualifications in 2022. As many will remember, that was when we had the big signature scandal fiasco that totally rocked the Republican gubernatorial primary race, disqualified a number of people, including some who were, you know, viewed as front runners at the time. And that, you know, we're still kind of seeing the fallout of that into 2024. You know, we're having candidates who are filing signatures that have been found by the Michigan Bureau of Elections. They're the individuals who review these petitions, make sure that you're filing enough, that they're, you know, valid signatures, that they match voters on file. And, you know, they're still finding that there are signature circulators out there who are taking candidates' money. And as an aside, candidates usually will end up paying circulators to go out and canvass and get these signatures, you know, as much as, you know, $9, $10 a signature. So it's a lucrative business. There's definitely a financial aspect here for individuals to want to try and cheat the system, so to speak. And these signature circulators we're finding are still turning back in fraudulent signatures. So, you know, that's an angle of things that we're probably going to still see moving forward until, you know, any kind of real crackdown happens on it. The three individuals, for instance, as just a point of reference, the three individuals who were found to have participated in the Republican gubernatorial signature fraud scandal, they're actually going to trial right now. So we'll see where and how that bears out. You know, that could in and of itself, depending on the harshness of the penalty they get, serve as a deterrent. And individuals might say, hey, you know, I'm not going to mess around with trying to turn in or give candidates fraudulent signatures, because many of these candidates don't realize or don't have the ability to double, triple check that these signatures are not fraudulent, or so is their claim to the Board of State canvassers. So they're, you know, just as much of a victim here as, you know, they claim voters who now don't have the ability to vote for these candidates because fraudulent signatures kept them from the ballot. But as an aside, too, we're also kind of seeing just a motley reasons for why people are being disqualified from the ballot. And it's kind of all over the place. Disqualifications happen. They are not infrequent to, you know, running for public office. And a lot of the times they do come down to, you know, the typeface on your petition was wrong, or you forgot to put in your home address, so all of your petitions are now invalid. And that's pretty common, but it's the fraud that we're really seeing has been, you know, it peaked in 2022. Now, hopefully we are on the downward trend of that.
You know, it's amazing. It seems like for decades and decades, you know, candidates for governor, U.S. Senate, Congress, the people who have to collect signatures to get on the ballot, for the most part, had no problem reaching the threshold of signatures from registered voters for access. But it's really mushroomed, I'd say, in the last 12 years. How much do you think the movement toward hiring paid signature gatherers has led to these problems, as opposed to just an army of volunteers that you can kind of trust are part of your campaign?
Well, it's like I mentioned, many of these paid signature circulators, they're being paid $9, $10, $11 a signature. And if you think, it's been a minute since I've actually seen a petition signature page, but I think they can hold anywhere from like 10 to 20 signatures. So, you know, you're looking at $100+ a page. There is a definite financial incentive to try and get as many of those turned in as you can. And especially if you're dealing with a candidate who might not be able to have the legal capabilities or financial capabilities to take you to court over effectively turning in fraud or defrauding these candidates for work that they're being paid for, it can pretty much go unpunished, unfortunately. And I know that that's what the canvassers are looking at, the Board of State canvassers. They're the four individuals, two Democrats, two Republicans, who are tasked with approving or denying people access to the ballot once they review their petition signatures. And it's not like they're saying, oh, hey, we don't like this candidate, so we're not going to let you on the ballot. They are quite literally just looking at the law and saying, you filed fraudulent signatures. I'm sorry, we can't let you on the ballot. So there's a financial incentive for these people to keep doing what they're doing and defrauding candidates. And until we end up either cracking down on it harder in state law or, you know, I guess I don't know what the Board of State Canvassers can independently decide to crack down on this on their own. We may still see this continue in coming election years.
Well, Jordan, thanks for joining us. All right, here's the big question. Are the Red Wings finally going to get back to the playoffs next year?
I want to say yes. I'm going to be optimistic.
We all do.
But in the meantime,
well, we can only hope.
The Lions.
Yeah, we do have the Lions. Thank goodness for that. And thanks for coming on, Jordan. We appreciate it.
Yeah, anytime.
Thanks again to our guest, Jordan Hermony from Bridge, Michigan. Mishmash is produced by WDET, Detroit's NPR station, in collaboration with Gongwer News Service. Mishmash is hosted and produced by me, Shayna Roth, and Gongwer's Zach Gorchow and Alethea Kasbin.
Additional production and editing by Hearns Laguerre Jr., mixing, mastering, and music by Sam Bobian.
Our digital team is Dave Kim, Sophia Joswiak, and Jenny Sherman. Our news director is Jerome Vaughn, and our podcast manager is David Lyons. As always, if you listen to this podcast and want to support it, you can do so by leaving us a review or comment wherever you listen. You can subscribe or follow us on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell your friends about how much you've learned from Mishmash and send them a link. Learn more about Gongwer News Service at GONGWER.com.
Remember, we're produced by a public radio station, which means we are listener supported. So if you really, really like this podcast, you can support WDET by going to WDET.org/give. We'll talk to you next week.